From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with two significant upsets in the recent primary elections. Think about these two names, David Gant and Joe Morelli. Those two men held New York State Assembly seats for decades. David Gant passed away recently and had planned to retire. Joe Morelli, of course, now a member of the U.S. Congress. Both had anointed successors who could take over the seats in Albany. David Gant supported county legislator Ernest Flagler. Joe Morelli supported county legislator Justin Wilcox. And both got beat badly. In the 136th Assembly District, Sarah Clark dominated the race, despite Morelli's support for Wilcox. Clark is a longtime staff member and director for Senators Hillary Clinton and Kirsten Gillibrand. We're going to talk to her later this hour. In the 137th Assembly District, community and labor organizer DeMond Meeks won a double-digit victory, despite David Gant's support for Ernest Flagler. This shakeup has been, well, a kind of a wake-up call for the Democratic Party, which is seeing an increasing number of party-designated candidates lose. First this hour, let me welcome back to the program the victorious DeMond Meeks.
Well, thanks for having me.
How surprised are you, if you are surprised at all, that you won this primary?
It's not so much a surprise, because I knew that going in, it would take a lot of work, and it would take just really making sure that the community was engaged in the process. And I believe we were able to do that in the effort that we put forth.
On election night, I mean, essentially June 23rd, even though we didn't have full results, we knew we had to wait for thousands, potentially, of absentee ballots. You had a big, big lead, I mean, a double-digit lead, and you held on to that lead. Were you concerned at any point that the process was going to be compromised? Did you feel like doing it this way, because, you know, we're in a pandemic and we had to count votes and had to do it over a number of days. Were you concerned about the process at all? Did you feel like it was fair and well observed?
Yeah, I was concerned about the process early on, and based upon the concerns that we had, we expressed those concerns. You know, we were quite transparent about the concerns that we had. You know, if it was an issue of voter suppression, we put a press release out there. If it was an issue of, you know, questioning different people involvement in the process, you know, we knew that the treasurer from another camp, another campaign, was actually working in the BOE and also took part in the absentee ballot process. So based upon that, we did have concern, and which we brought to the attention of the powers that be, and they began to make moves in order to rectify those issues.
Yeah, let's just make sure that our listeners understand. So what you're saying is the treasurer of one of your opponent's campaigns, and in this case I can surmise that it's the main challenger that you had in this race, that's Ernest Flagler, treasurer of that campaign works for the Board of Elections and was involved with counting the votes. And so you can understand why anyone would be nervous about the count there, but at the same time, you don't want to allege that a person is not able to do their job with integrity. So ultimately, how did you resolve that? I mean, did that person still work in the process? Did you simply make sure that you had people in the room watching the process, asking questions? How did it work out, DeMond?
Yeah, we have people in the room watching the process. We expressed our concerns to the commissioners at the Board of Election, and we also, you know, follow through with our attorneys presenting a letter making the request, in which in turn they remove that person from the process.
Okay, and I also want to ask you a little bit about how you think the BOE did. Again, this is a first-time scenario dealing with the pandemic, dealing with a much higher percentage of absentee ballots, and having to do it a very different way. Having said that, there's been a lot of criticism of the commissioners, a lot of criticism of the lack of communication with the public, the confusion about polling places on the 23rd and on other parts of the process. Are you part of those critics? Are you among those critics who think that this was handled poorly or could have been much better? Do you think it's understandable that there would be blips? I mean, how do you rate the work here? Because this matters, DeMond. We're going towards November, yeah, and we've got to get this right.
I think we definitely have to work collectively as a community to assure that we improve this process. I do know for a fact that in the history of probably in the past 30, 40 years, they've never experienced, this type of absentee ballot process. It was my understanding from talking with someone at the BOE, at the Board of Elections, the most they've ever had to deal with as it relates to absentee ballots was 25,000. So you can imagine to go from, experiencing 25,000 at some point in history to, 70 plus thousand. I mean, that's a huge difference. And it definitely could present a challenge. It could present a challenge. Yeah.
So the Democrat and Chronicle keyed in on two assembly races and two victors in their primary campaigns. That was you and that was Sarah Clark. And the Democrat and Chronicle writes that those two victories shook up the political foundation for Democrats in our region because in each of the races, there was a candidate that was backed by either the party itself, an endorsed or a supported candidate, a designated candidate, I should say, mm-hmm. but also supported by, in your race, Ernest Flagler had the support of people who've been close to David Gant for years, who David Gant, of course, retiring from that seat and then passed away. And then also in Sarah Clark's race, Justin Wilcox had the support of people who've been close to Congressman Joe Morelli. And the idea that the Democrat and Chronicle carried forward was those political establishment machines got beat and that this is a significant change in direction for the party. Do you view it that way?
I just view it as, it's a primary, right? It's part of the process. And it was an opportunity for individuals who were seeking those seats to get out there and let their voice be heard by the community. And I believe the community spoke by way of their votes. And, I just want to recognize Assemblyman David Gant and the work that he's done. He was in that office since 1983, and God rest his soul. His homegoing service, his wake is today at Church of Love over on Exchange Street, and that will be from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m. For those who want to stop by and pay their respects. And the service is tomorrow, but it will be a private funeral service.
What will the legacy of David Gant be for this community?
I would say just, one who would speak, on issues. I definitely recognize his commitment to youth in this community, being one who was a part of a number of different youth initiatives, including Baden Street. There was a commitment to help youth and to assure that, some of those programs had the resources that were need. Pushing a sense of excellence and pushing people to do more and to be more, scholarship foundations. And when you look at this community, there's a number of people who are in leadership roles who had some form of a start or a period of time in which they worked under the leadership of Assemblyman David Gant. There's a number of individuals. I'll just name a few. Myself, Damon Meeks, back when I was 15, 16 years old, I had the opportunity to intern in David's office under the leadership of Wade Norwood. Jeff McCann, who currently works with Adam Bellow, was in that office at that time. Larry Knox, who's with 1199 SEIU, Ben Felder, Ernest Flagler, Lovely Warren, Willie Lightfoot. The list goes on and on. There's a number of individuals in this community who are doing work that have, worked with David, Assemblyman David Gant at some period in time and, reap benefit thereof.
Were you disappointed that the late Assemblyman didn't back you directly?
No, I wasn't. Sometimes people have discussions, sometimes years out, and people may forecast different things and say, hey, well, this is the way we want to move. Or a person may say, hey, I'm interested in doing X, Y, Z. For me, it was truly a leap of faith, not just what Damon wanted to do or what was in the best interest of Damon Meeks. I've worked for 1199 SEIU for the past 10 years and made a decent wages. Also had, great benefits for myself and my family. And to be in a position where you're taking a leap of faith and making a commitment to walk away from a sure thing and move forward and just walk by faith. And I knew that this was something that my God had called me to do in this season, and that's how I moved forward.
Have you heard from Mayor Warren since your victory?
Yes.
Was it a good conversation?
Yes, it is. It was a good conversation. And, you know, and for me, just looking across the state and looking at some of the different delegations that have been in Albany and worked on different things, across the state, you see delegations, mixed delegations, Democrats and Republicans, working together for the greater good of their community. And that's what we have to commit to. I've said it from day one, as far as my campaign was concerned, we cannot continue to operate in silos. We must come together collectively to effect needed change in the Rochester Monroe County community. And that's what I'm committed to. So, you know, for those who were opposition during the primary, that was the case. Now that we're past that primary, we're coming together, and we'll state moving into November, vote row A all the way. The Democrats are here, and we're going to make a change, and we're going to work with whoever, whatever the delegation may consist of, Democrats, Republicans, or anything in between, to assure that we're doing what's in the best interest of the Rochester Monroe County community.
Got a few more minutes with Damon Meeks, who won his primary campaign for state assembly, and just based on history, he's got to win in November, but almost certainly on his way to the New York State Assembly. Has that hit you yet? I ask because, you know, the last time we talked, you were in the middle of your campaign. I will tell you that the number of people who have told me privately, watch that race. You know, a lot of people knew the name Ernest Flagler, of course, but they said the amount of people who told me Damon Meeks is going to outwork and shock people because of his work ethic and the way he's made connections in the community. I think your win did not surprise a lot of people who are very close to the process. And I think that's a credit to you. And now it's real.
Thank you.
Now it's real. So all the things that you and I talked about the last time you were on this program, you've got a chance to shift your focus now and think about what you're actually going to do, assuming you win this seat here. Has that hit you yet? And what do you think is now the most important work for you to be doing?
Right now, the most important work for me to do is to continue the service in the community. Also, begin to become more well-versed and well-studied as it relates to the different responsibilities and lean on, you know, my brothers and sisters who have been in Albany and who have done the work and to get information from them. But we're also moving forward in a manner in which we stated from day one, community town hall meetings. And we'll begin those before we're even sworn in. We want to talk to people and find out, hey, what are the issues? So in moving forward, we know, hey, these are the top three priorities of the Rochester Monroe County community, and this is how we're going to work collectively to achieve these particular goals.
You can't do it all when you're part of the state assembly. You've got a role in your district. What does it mean to be successful in the New York State Assembly for your district, Damon?
It means so much. I mean, so much is riding on this. When you're talking about the two major areas as far as spending in New York State, being healthcare and education, those are areas that we really need to affect some change in this county, and we have to do it. We have to do it. So it means so much. It means our livelihood. It means a brighter future for the community, and in particular for the youth, as well as the seniors, the elders.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about one aspect of elections in 2020 that I think is going to be very, very important as we go toward November. When you look at surveys, generally speaking, and again, this is not everybody, but this is a general categorical way of assessing things based on surveys, African-American voters trust mail-in votes less than white voters. So black voters are less likely to vote by mail when you look at surveys. And that may be, I think, illustrated by the Monroe County Clerk's race, in which the same day and early voting, in other words, the in-person voting, Jennifer Butte had a lead over the county clerk, Jamie Romeo. And then when they counted the absentee ballots, Jamie Romeo won quite comfortably. She won a large, large share of the absentee ballots. That doesn't mean that all black voters voted for Jennifer Butte and none voted for Jamie Romeo. Not at all. But when you look at those surveys, it indicates there is less trust in the black community of mail-in voting. And this is a year when we need people to trust mail-in voting. It's going to be part of what we do as a country in November. Are you concerned about that? What's the message you have for voters?
The key thing, and this is the responsibility of leaders in this community, people who have any type of platform, whether it's your social media platform, whether it's the pulpit of your church, whether you're in a county-led city council, and so on, it's our responsibility to educate the masses on the process. And that's something that I feel that we must improve. When we went into the ballot, went into the polls to vote in this primary, a number of people were not aware in advance that they would have to vote in two different ballots. They would have to vote on two different ballots. They came in and it's like, okay, you have one ballot and you have to sign in at this table. Now you have to go and sign in at another table and vote on that particular ballot. So I think from now until November, we have to do our due diligence to utilize our platforms and educate the community on the voting process. And that's something that we're committed to.
Has this all hit you yet that you won?
Yeah, you know, I would say yes in some regards, in other regards, no. Just really excited and ready to do the work. And, you know, one of the most powerful things that we can do is really utilize this platform and get out there in the community and speak life into folks and get them engaged and say, hey, you know what, this is yours and you must play a part in order for us to be successful and the changes that are needed. I also want to, speaking of changes, regarding a Black Lives Matter rally tomorrow, mm-hmm. There's a Black Lives Matter labor rally at Union 30 North Union Street, and that's over at the Teachers Union. And it's being held by the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. And it's basically recognizing that, you know, Black Lives Matter to the to labor. And we're calling all members of the community as well as members of labor to come out and support those efforts. So that's taking place tomorrow at 1 p.m. at 30 North Union Street. So I just want to put that out there.
And if you could, before I let you go, just tell me a little bit more about Black Lives Matter and labor connecting those movements. What would it mean for black citizens in Rochester to have a chance to really become more part of the labor movement, to work more? How satisfied are you with that relationship right now? How much work still has to be done?
Not nearly as satisfied as I would like to be. I know that there's a lot more work that could be done and that need to be done. When we look at projects that are going up, different construction sites, different projects that are taking place in our community, they should be more reflective of the community. We have to do our due diligence to assure that individuals are that they have opportunities to take up these trades. Years ago, you had programs at Edison Tech in which students could graduate high school with a skilled trade under their belt. And we must get back to that as it relates to the city school district. We see it in some of our suburban districts like Webster, working with BOCES, students who may not be going to college, getting them involved in skilled trades, and they're graduating high school with a skilled trade under their belt, and they're able to make a way for themselves. So we have to make sure that we're recognizing that all of our students may not be going to college. However, they can find a skilled trade or a craft that they could be a success, that they can be successful in their own right and make a difference.
And are there jobs? Are there jobs that will be sustainably available if people get those skills?
Absolutely. I mean, when you talk about skilled trades, those are things that can't be outsourced. I mean, they're not outsourcing the building of houses, the building of new buildings in downtown Rochester, the beautician, the barber. I mean, these are things that you just can't outsource, right? Because those are needs of the community. And I think that we need to make sure that we're giving individuals those trades. When we look at the African-American community for far too long, when a person has a felony, there's so many doors that are shut. So even with a felony, if you have a skilled trade, you have the ability to market yourself by your skills, and you can still provide for yourself and your family. And we need to assure that we're opening those doors for the community. across the board.
All right, and forgive me, one more question, but I think it's important that I just get one take from you on the pandemic, and that is on the subject of the disparity in those who've been afflicted with COVID-19 and the number of deaths across the country. Our community sees a little bit lower in terms of total disparity, but there's still a disparity. We know that Black and brown Americans have suffered more. People in poverty have suffered more. And I think right now in New York State, it's we're watching the South go through a lot of what we went through in March, April, and May. But that doesn't, mean, that doesn't mean it's over. And I just want to get your sense of what you want to see this community do to prepare to deal with this pandemic as effectively as we can collectively until it's over, whenever it's whenever that end comes.
Educate. And we have to meet people where they are. At, you know, if they're standing on a corner, if they're, you know, walking down the street, if they're at the laundromat, wherever they may be, we have to meet them where they are and make sure that we're educating them on COVID-19. All too often, we have what I recognize as like urban myths, right? People come up with these different ideas of who can catch what and who can't catch what. Or, you know, if you do this, it'll protect you. If you do that, it'll protect you. And we need to look at the facts, the scientific facts of COVID-19, and make sure that we're educating the community and meeting them where they are. We can't simply depend on a press conference. We can't simply depend on an email or social media. We have to get out in the community and meet people where they are. It may call for a door-to-door effort, but we have to educate the masses on COVID-19. And I think that's where we really assure that we you know, protect ourselves as a community.
I know Demond Meeks has to win in November before he heads to the New York State Assembly, but the odds are pretty high historically, if you look at it, that that's what's going to happen. And I just want to say how much we appreciate the conversation with you, and I hope we can look forward to talking to you a lot more as you represent the community. Thank you very much, and once again, congratulations on your win.
All right, thank you. You have a great day.
That's Demond Meeks, who is all but certain now to head to Albany as a member of the New York State Assembly. After our only break, we welcome another primary winner, Sarah Clark. Coming up in our second hour, the University of Rochester is conducting a little experiment of sorts. Project Imagine is charged with reimagining how education is done. We're not just talking about during the pandemic. We're talking about beyond the pandemic. They're looking at changing the academic calendar, reorganizing from traditional departments to more interdisciplinary models, and a lot more. And we'll talk about it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our next guest is also a victor in the recent primary. Now, she does have to win in November. I was a little cheeky with Demond Meeks. He doesn't have an opponent on the ballot, and that's why I said he's all but certainly going to Albany. It's a formality in November. Sarah Clark will have to win in November, but again, odds are that history says she will. The big race was the primary. She had to win a three-way contested primary in the Democratic Party, and she won big. She's on the line with us now. Sarah Clark, welcome back to the program, and congratulations to you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
There's a rule of pandemic interviewing. The dog always barks when we start talking.
The moment we start talking.
That's
Thank
okay.
You.
Hey, that's just real life. That is just real life. I've seen a couple of numbers. What's the final number you saw? You won by something like 40 to 45 points in this. What was the final margin you saw?
I think ended at 63%, and then I'm not quite sure where the other two candidates were, but we ended at 63 once the absentees were counted.
I mean, the old saw in politics is your goal is to get what the other guy got plus one, and I know you'd have taken that, but can you believe that you're winning by that you win this thing by 45 points? If I would have told you that a month ago, 2 months ago, what would you have thought?
I don't think I would have believed you. We had a strong message. We were, you know, excited to put my experience and background and involvement in the community for so many decades to work and see how people responded. But obviously, there were not just, you know, other candidates, but public health challenges and how to campaign. So I think there were a lot of unknowns, but we stayed strong to the message and really used my network of folks that I've worked with for so many years and their networks. And so I guess honored and humbled would be the word that it ended up being the numbers it did, but not at all what I expected.
Sure. And I think the Democrat and Chronicle said kind of the quiet part out loud. Brian Sharp's article keys in on the fact that your race and DeMond Meek's race were characterized by the fact that these longtime party leaders, the now late David Gantt and Joe Morelli, had essentially selected candidates who could move into those seats comfortably. David Gantt had personally endorsed and helped recruit Ernest Flagler for the race against DeMond Meeks, and that did not work out for Flagler, obviously. Joe Morelli, obviously he's not the most recent person who was in that seat. That was Jamie Romeo, who became county clerk. But Joe Morelli had been supporting, and a lot of his team had been supporting, Justin Wilcox. And what Brian Sharp and the Democrat and Chronicle are saying is that this is a shockwave through establishment politics, that Gantt and Morelli were people for decades who could do a lot of picking and choosing, that they would say, this is the candidate, everyone clear the deck, this is who it's going to be. How come that didn't work this time?
Well, I think you're seeing in a lot of races, not just here, but across the country, that people are really open and excited for fresh voices and new candidates. So I don't think it's completely unique to Rochester. You know, for me, having worked in the Senate for 19 years as a staffer for these two amazing senators, I did work with all our elected officials across our community. So although I never felt, or I was never sort of really part of the behind-the-scenes political campaigning, even I only joined my local committee 2 years ago. So that part was all very new to me, but I still felt that no matter what, my work with all our elected officials over the years, regardless, I mean, I had my boss's support in the race, so it made perfect sense to me that Congressman Raleigh would support one of his old staffers as well. For me, it meant then that I just had to turn and really run on my experience and who I was and what I thought my voice would bring to this seat. But I think you're just seeing a lot of ability in people who are really ready for new voices. And you know, when you put it to the voters, they have their own ideas about who they want in these seats. I engaged a lot of people who probably couldn't have named a bunch of assembly members mm-hmm. from our community, and they got really excited. And I think that's, you saw it in the final numbers. We had about 15,000 folks voting in this assembly race. We were expecting maybe 12,000 at most. So it was great to see huge engagement and more people voting. So I think that makes a difference.
Do you know offhand, out of those 15,000 votes cast in this race, how many were by mail?
9,000. A little less than 9,000.
More than half.
Yes, more than half.
Okay.
In my assembly district, yep.
Got an email. I got an email from a listener. Maybe you can answer for this. She says, important for us to know and prepare for, will we have two ballots again in the fall?
That is a good question. You know, there was this thought that it would, I don't think so. I don't see why we would. It should be just one general election ballot. I think there was probably a spacing issue with the presidential. You had all those delegates you had to put on. So I don't know if they could have combined. Plus the fact that, you know, originally those two primaries were supposed to be on two different dates. So I'm sure some of that was already printed long before it was combined. So that confusion hopefully will not be here in November.
You satisfied with the way the election was run locally? As you know, there's been a lot of criticism about confusion, about the shrunken number of polling sites, about communication with voters, about a lot of different things. What's your assessment?
You know, overall, obviously, there were a lot of issues that popped up, and we have to make sure that we deal with those. You never want to hear someone getting the wrong ballot or someone not getting access to vote. Historically, you know, I've driven people to the polls and all of that, and they like their polls. To, you know, there's places to vote to be right in their neighborhood. So that was, I think we underestimated the number of people who were going to vote in person on Election Day, based on the huge volume of absentees that came in. But there are still a large group of folks in my district. I mean, 5,900 voted on Election Day. That was a big number compared to, you know, when we thought about all the ballots we knew were in. So, yeah, the combined, my site was different. It was not in walking distance anymore. And there was a lot of confusion around it. But there was a lot of confusion around a lot this year. And the BOE had a lot to deal with, including a mail campaign, a mail-in system that wasn't really built for this kind of volume. And the fact that, you know, schools were closed and all these sites that we have usually used that are accessible just weren't available. But I think from everything I've heard, they both commissioners have learned a lot, and we will be better by November.
Boy, I hope so, because there there's no doubt that the White House is already trying to sow doubt about the legitimacy of the coming election. They have tried to cast doubt on mail-in voting. And I think if there are the kinds of problems we saw locally, if that happens in a lot of different places around the country, that's only going to bolster the idea that this didn't work and we can't trust the results. We cannot afford that as a country. That's not a partisan statement. That is me as a citizen of this country saying we need a functional system, even in a pandemic. So what are the first changes that have to be made? What has to be shored up?
Well, I think we need to look at other states that do. I mean, we're moving towards a better and more robust mailing in process. That had happened already in the state legislature and was something that was going to take a year or two. But we need to look at other states that do that well, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are systems we can replicate. We have to, you know, I think about all the challenges we had about how do you train all these volunteers in a pandemic when you're telling people not to congregate or be, you know, in the same room with other folks. So, you know, we did learn, but we have to make sure we're doing a more robust training for our workers that are there. I think we still have to realize people will vote in person, barring anything extreme happening. But the absentee system, although there were some various, you know, hiccups with it, I felt the counting, and having observed it for a day, I felt like they were doing a good job. The ballots were counted. So, and all 60,000 plus of them. So I did feel, you know, to watch that in action and see that volume of ballots being counted did give me a sense of, all right, we can do this. Mm-hmm. We can do this.
You're going to be working on the state level, obviously, if you win in November. But I am curious to know if your relationship with Congressman Morelli, do you have a good relationship? Do you expect to have a good relationship?
Absolutely. We've already talked, and, you know, we've had a great relationship for 19 years. For me, this primary, and I keep saying this to more and more people, like, our county is becoming more blue. It's not just the city anymore. We have to get comfortable with primaries. It's often the only choice for our voters. So for me, there was never any malice or anything. I always went in this excited to just put my message out there. I like Justin, you know, I've known him for a long time as well. So for me, this was just about my message. I was always very comfortable with the primary process, and we now all have, you know, these really important races to win in November, and we have to get some, we have two Senate seats that are really important for our community to flip those, and I'm just really excited to work with him and everyone to make sure we have this great state delegation going to Albany.
Well, the last couple of years haven't been all that good for the local Democratic Party in terms of their designated candidates, and we've seen other candidates make similar remarks that it can be difficult when you are not designated. You kind of have to work uphill, but the voters have chosen a pretty significant number of non-designated candidates. You know, and that's really inside baseball, I think, for some listeners who go, I don't even know what you're talking about. Why are we designating candidates at all? Should we still be designating candidates this way, Sarah?
It's funny because, like I said, I only joined my committee 2 years ago. So for me, as much as I feel like I've been in the political world a long time, there was still a lot I didn't even know I didn't know, which I think is always the uphill climb when you're not part of more of the inside political groups that have been running campaigns for a long time. So I'm not sure. Obviously, I've never been successful at designation. But I also think, do we need to get rid of designation? I'm not sure, but we can do a lot more to with our committees, with the committee. I mean, here are 1,800 dedicated Democrats who want to be part of a process that helps get Democrats elected. So I think some changes are needed. Whether it's getting rid of designation completely, I don't know. I do think it is somewhat divisive, pitting Democrats against Democrats, and it kind of sometimes can make the primary process feel more uncomfortable than it should be. So I think we could do a lot to look at it and maybe make some changes, and maybe that includes getting rid of designation. I just don't know.
Yeah, and to be clear for listeners, that doesn't mean no primaries. In fact,
right.
Sarah Clark is saying the opposite. All parties should get used to viewing primaries as a normal part of doing politics, that's a healthy thing, that voters in a primary get a good choice of multiple candidates. But the difference is a party designation can carry sort of the imprimatur of this will be the choice, though the voters have rejected that in recent years in many, many races. So there's a lot of jockeying that goes on sort of behind closed doors. It's very competitive. It can, for some candidates, it has felt very personal. Were you able to make it not feel personal to you in this particular campaign?
Yes, because I didn't have high expectations.
you knew what you were getting into. Yeah.
Yes. But for me, it was a great opportunity to, as someone who's a staffer, you don't spend a lot of time out there getting your own message, concise and in a way that people are listening to, and it's always about your boss. So for me, I used designation as a way to hone my message and really work on what was connecting with voters, even regardless of the results. But like you said, thank goodness for my husband. He kept telling me, so few people know what that even means, Sarah. Like, it's okay. So
he's right.
I mean, people have no clue. So I had to sort of stop always thinking inside baseball and realize that I just need to focus on this huge community of voters and figuring out ways to connect with them.
Yeah, just from my observation on the outside, not being inside the committees and not being part of that designation process, what I have heard from people who are interested in politics is the entire system makes it harder for fresh voices to get involved. In other words, it feels like there's always a get in line, there's a hierarchy, and the Democrats in particular have pushed new voices out in favor of this person paid their dues, now this person's going to go, now this person. And I wonder if you think there's something to that, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing this not just here, but everywhere. I still think the AOC win downstate was probably one of the biggest upsets we've ever seen in the last few years
mm-hmm.
in terms of a Democratic primary. I definitely think that we are, the voters themselves really don't have a clue or understand that inside baseball process. And for them, they're just sometimes that fresh voice or that different voice is what resonates, especially as we are increasing our Democratic registration in Monroe County and getting more and more voices part of the process.
Well, in just a moment, we're going to talk about some of the issues that Sarah Clark is excited to get to work on here. She won a dominant primary victory, more than 40 points, a primary victory over Justin Wilcox and Nelson Lopatin in the contested Democratic primary for that assembly seat. A lot of people thought this would be a close race. It was not. It was an absolute blowout. So for women who want to run, I'm always sort of kind of careful with these kind of questions, Sarah, because I don't want to make it seem like, hey, you're a woman, you won, great, because women can't, but we still know that women are underrepresented in most parts of government in this country, whether it's the U.S. Congress or state level. That's obviously changing in some places more rapidly than others. So I don't want to overemphasize the idea that, hey, you're a woman, you won. But you are a woman, you won. You won a dominant victory. And it's still harder for women to win than men these days. What's your advice for women who want to run in the future?
You know, and that's partly why I did run, is I've been spending the last few years really encouraging, supporting, giving you know, fresh new candidates access to my networks and some of my fundraising ability. And, you know, at some point you start to say to yourself, I keep convincing these women to run or supporting these women to run and telling them how hard it is. And they keep saying, well, why aren't you running, Sarah? And I finally decided that I needed to make the leap myself. It is hard. I am blessed with the fact that I have all these connections and have worked so deep in the community for 19 years. And it makes a difference when you need to raise money or you need to, you know, do a Zoom call with someone's book club. It just helps to have these already exist. There's a lot of campaign classes out there that teach this to women, tell them to grow their networks. We are so afraid to ask. I mean, I tell the biggest story was, you know, I did get my former boss, Hillary Clinton, to endorse, but I wasn't afraid to ask her, but I just was like, I can win this on my own. And it was someone else who said, Sarah, she loved having you work for her. You still help out, you know, once in a while. Ask her. And as soon as I did, she was like, why did you not tell me this, Sarah? I'm so excited. I can't wait to support you. And I think that's an issue women run into, is we're afraid to ask for things. But yet everyone wants to support and help. So we need to just get better at that.
Don't be afraid to ask. No, I hear that. Sarah Clark, our guest here. So let's talk a little bit about some of the issues then that are about to be front and center for you, assuming you go to Albany. And I know you'd like to get past November 1st. What changes for you? Do you start really kind of putting your attention toward the issues that you're going to have a chance to work on in the New York State Assembly if you win? Is this still full throttle campaign? What shifts for you now?
I think it's, you know, I have 19 years in the Senate that I have to sort of wrap up. I do have an opponent in November, but not on a major line. So I do feel very comfortable and okay that it should, you know, if I still do my work and make sure I give my message out to more of the community and get in touch with folks, I feel confident about the November election. Mm-hmm. But obviously there's still some more work to do. So for me, I do think I'm starting to turn my focus into the district a little more, making sure I'm connecting with more people, hearing their priorities, and making sure that that's part of my messaging. And sort of looking to wrap up my 19 years of my previous life and move on. So it's kind of both.
Yeah. And so as you mentioned, you worked for then Senator Hillary Clinton and you've worked for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. When does that work officially end?
We haven't made a final decision on it. I'm going to take a little time off right now. From both worlds, and it's been a very exhausting two full-time job worlds for the last few months. We're starting those conversations now and looking to see how that will all transpire. And I don't want to lose focus on the November election and make any huge assumptions. So it's still really focused on making sure we're doing what we need to do to win.
By the way, Senator Gillibrand, of course, briefly ran for president and has been a strong supporter of the Democratic Party and Joe Biden. Are you disappointed, though, with Senator Gillibrand, with Senator Klobuchar, Senator Harris, Senator Warren, you know, among many women who ran for president, that it wasn't a woman that the Democrats chose in this time around?
I am disappointed. You know, the joke we had during petitioning is the biggest signature day we got in terms of volume per hour was the day Amy dropped out, Amy Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar. She was the last woman in, and there were a lot of people at a lot of doors, particularly women, who were like, if you have a woman candidate, I'm signing right now. There was a sense of loss when she dropped out. There were so many choices. It's just, you start to get to this point where you're like, maybe it's not just this one particular woman. Maybe it is just a bigger issue that we need to examine and look at. So I hope we keep those conversations. I'll be interested to see who Joe Biden picks as his VP and where that puts us. But yeah, I wish I had seen a woman at the ticket, at the top of the ticket for sure.
Well, in your race, you and your opponents agreed on a lot of things and you disagreed on a few, especially on this program. One of those issues was universal health care and what's actually possible. And Justin Wilcox had argued that it's important to be pragmatic, to understand what's doable on the state level, what's within reach, what can get accomplished. And you seemed, at least the way I would characterize it, as not willing to let traditional political challenges mar what you're striving to achieve and not let sort of past results determine what you're willing to attempt in the future on healthcare. Is that fair?
It is fair. You know, I think we've tried lots of tweaks, and to say there isn't money in the system to reimagine and redo it to make it a much more accessible, you look at COVID and the disparities in health outcomes with it. If we don't get to a place where healthcare is accessible similarly for everyone, we're going to continue to have these struggles. And healthcare isn't just about your physical health. We know there is trauma with poor health. You know, just living in poverty is a health outcome. And if we don't give better, if we're not bold, we're not going to change this. And I get that there's math to figure out, and we have to do a lot to look at how this happens, but I think we need to double down on a really bold idea of giving everybody public health care, whether it's at the state level and then hopefully at the national level.
Yeah, this is a governor who's obviously picked up even more of a national profile during the pandemic, and he still holds regular news conferences. His news conferences for a couple of months were picked up nationally, and so he always holds a lot of sway anyway, but he's particularly sort of, I kind of elevated in profile and perhaps status during this pandemic. And he has been, a naysayer is the wrong word. I think he is also a pragmatist on viewing what is possible. So if the Democrats don't have leadership from the top, can you expect to get health care done the way you want it at the state level?
I think so. I think there's a lot of support in the legislature, and you know, I've been saying this a lot. Over the last few months, we were in a truly health crisis, which we still are in and still need to deal with. But we're slowly moving into what's going to become a real human crisis. We have the large $600 a week unemployment bump up ending soon. We have the eviction protections ending soon. So we're moving into this human crisis, and I think healthcare is one of those. And the legislature, I think, can work. I think we'll work in partnership. I think you can be pragmatic and work with a pragmatic governor, but still have a really strong voice to be bold, and he can be convinced, I'm sure.
Well, now, those last couple of minutes, you mentioned that $600 ending soon. When does that end?
July 25th, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Is, you know, if you were working in Albany right now, how worried would you be about what the impact of that's going to be?
Well, I think I would be like many others, crossing their fingers and hoping that the Senate moves on a package similar to the House Heroes package that was passed that will help. And I do think there's a lot of hope that there will be at least something passed through the Senate, especially given what we're seeing in states across the country. So I would be doing that first and foremost, and I do have some faith that there will be something, but I am worried. I think there's going to be a bigger economic reckoning when that ends. So we need to be wary and making sure that our communities are getting their basic rights met, whether it's housing and healthcare or food. So we really need to make sure that we are looking at that whole picture as these things change and programs end.
Sure. And 45 seconds, Sarah. The governor has emphasized he would love to do more. The state leaders would love to do more. But states are out of money. They want federal support for states and localities, and that there is a limit to what the state can do. How concerned are you about that?
I am. I mean, they've already put out that 20% across the board cut and what it would look like. So if we don't get some federal aid that helps with revenue loss, we are going to be hurting, I think, both in our schools and just in our cities and towns across the state. So I am worried, but I'm going to be optimistic and hope that the federal government comes through. And, you know, regardless of what happens, we have a lot to do to recover. We have to roll up our sleeves and get to work.
Well, if and when you go to the state assembly, even more people are going to want your ear. And I just want you to know, I hope you come back to this program often. The door will be open and we'll be eager to have those conversations as you move into doing state assembly work. Sarah, thank you so much for making the time today. And I know we will talk soon.
Thank you. Enjoy your weekend.
Sarah Clark, victorious in her primary in the Democratic Party, and looks to be on her way to the New York State Assembly. You heard Damon Meeks, two candidates who were not designated by the party, not backed by longtime leaders of the party, but voters overwhelmingly said, those are the candidates we want. Big shakeup in the Democratic Party. Short break, more connections coming up.